Today's podcast of The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Talk about a dramatic turnaround. Last year, Ford Motor Company lost a record $14 billion. But the Detroit automaker won both the Car and Truck of the Year awards, and tomorrow, it could post its first profit since 2005. I talked to Ford CEO Alan Mulally and asked him how he was feeling.
Fine, thanks.
Pretty good. Better than last year about this time, right?
what a difference a year makes.
The State of the Union for Ford is strong, not just in Detroit, but also on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning. It's Wednesday, January 27th. The takeaway for me is, you know, heck, if Ford could have that kind of turnaround in a year, maybe the rest of us.
It's a $14 billion spread. That's
no
pretty
kidding.
Good.
Yes, or more. Could be 15 or 16.
Well, a billion here, a billion there. Let's get right to the top stories we're following this morning. President Obama will try to move past rocky times for the nation and himself tonight in his first State of the Union address. He'll look to reassure a recession-weary nation he's got a plan to stem the tide of red ink and to create jobs. We've been telling you all week about his plans to help middle-class families and a proposed freeze in domestic spending. This morning, we're learning the president will also call for a $4 billion increase in education funding, as well as new legislation that would change student lending. But White House spokesman Robert Gibbs says the main topic tonight will be the economy.
The president will talk about ensuring that we begin to get our fiscal house in order.
To that end, the president plans to issue an executive order creating a task force to tackle the federal deficit, an idea that was voted down in the Senate yesterday. The task force won't have the power to force Congress to vote on its suggestions, but the plan is to reduce the deficit, which stands at $1.3 trillion, or $4,500 for every American. Indiana Senator Evan Bayh says reducing that number is the important first step.
I have not detected a level of anger and cynicism about the federal government in my lifetime as high as it is today.
Well, the cynicism and anger will be directed at the president tonight in front of the television. He will be speaking at 9 p.m. Eastern time.
Analysts are calling Toyota's move unprecedented. It's suspending U.S. sales of eight of its most popular models, including the Camry and the Corolla, while it works to fix faulty gas pedals. Toyota is also planning to stop production at six North American plants starting next week. Back to Ford, I spoke to Ford CEO Alan Mulally yesterday, and I asked if he thought Ford will post a profit tomorrow.
Well, you absolutely have the right date. That's the date we're going to do our fourth quarter and year-end results, and at that time we'll update the fourth quarter performance, our year-end performance, and also provide our guidance for 2010.
A creative way to not answer the question.
Cagey
Ford's
there.
Earnings come out tomorrow. Industry experts are predicting they'll post a profit. We'll continue with Ford CEO Alan Mulally in just a moment.
So Ford's expecting a profit. GM finally found a buyer for Saab. It signed a deal with Dutch automaker Spyker Cars. They're an exotic sort of boutique car maker. It's worth $74 million in cash. In London today, they're talking about Yemen. Tomorrow it will be Afghanistan. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton is attending the International Conference, where today they are looking at the risk posed by terrorists in Yemen and how best to deal with them.
Here at home, voters in Oregon have voted to raise taxes on businesses and people who earn more than six figures a year. And at the Australian Open today, defending champ Serena Williams advanced to the semifinals, but she will not be joined by her sister Venus, who lost this morning. Looking at the markets, Asian and European markets are down, futures are mixed. The Dow will start at 10,194, the S&P at 1,092, and the NASDAQ opens at 2203. Later this hour, she's not Julia Child, but she is a child.
Today we're making a sage risotto with pecorino cheese. It's going to be gooey.
We're going to talk to an 11-year-old chef for tips on how you can cook with your family and make it fun and delicious later on in the show.
Tonight is President Obama's State of the Union address. We want to give you a chance to weigh in. What's your six words to describe the State of the Union or the state of Obama's job performance? Reach us at 8778-MY-TAKE or post it on our website, thetakeaway.org. Coming up, Alan Mulally at Ford, a happy man. What about his industry?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Ford Motor Company lost billions in 2008, but when they announce their earnings tomorrow, it may turn out that 2009 was considerably different. What does that say about the state of our union and economy? Maybe it only says something about our next guest, Alan Mulally, the president and CEO of the Ford Motor Company. I spoke to him yesterday from the Washington Auto Show. Ford earned just shy of $2 billion in the first 9 months of 2009, and I asked Mulally how he's turned it around for Ford.
Well, I think I would take us back to 3 years ago, where we developed a point of view about the kind of company that we wanted to create with Ford. And at that time, we decided that we were going to focus on the Ford brand. So that led us to divest of the other brands, as everybody knows. And then we also decided that we were going to have a complete family of vehicles that the consumers wanted in every market segment. So small, medium, and large cars, utilities, and trucks. We also decided, Celeste, at that time, that every new vehicle that we designed and produced would be best in class. And we defined that in terms of quality, fuel efficiency, safety, smart design that makes us even a better driver, and, of course, the very best value. And so we went to the banks, we got the financing in place for this tremendous transformation, and clearly during the worst of times as the recession increased, we had sufficient liquidity so we could continue on our plan. We accelerated the development of the new products and services that you're seeing today, and we restructured ourselves to get back to profitability, as you pointed out, in the third quarter. So we are here now as the recession starts to turn that with the products that people really do want and value. And it's very gratifying to see the response that we're getting for the new products.
Let me ask you about the state of the union for the auto industry. I mean, the auto industry that used to be just the cornerstone of the American economy, not just the American economy, but the American middle class. What is the state of the union for the auto industry now? Will it ever be the cornerstone that it once was?
Well, I sure think so, Celeste, because the United States has a very, very viable automobile industry. I mean, it's a very robust automobile market. The neat thing about Ford is that we are actually now growing our market share in the United States and around the world, which is terrific for our customers as well as everybody associated with the automobile industry. Another thing, Celeste, I think is neat about the U.S. auto industry and Ford in particular is that we are part of the solution for energy independence, energy security, national defense, sustainability. So this is an important industry for all of us in the United States and around the world.
Well, now the auto industry is becoming a leader. They kind of had to be drug kicking and screaming into that. But it feels like perhaps when you talk about a viable auto industry, that really what you're talking about is the new face of the auto industry, which is much leaner, much fewer dealerships, not nearly as high starting wages as we were used to. This is not the same exact auto industry which established Detroit as the richest city in the world at one point and created this very well-off middle class. This is a leaner and, in some cases, cheaper auto industry.
There's a lot of truth in that, but of course, the most important thing as an industry, because this is business, is to make sure that you do have your businesses sized so the production is matching the current demand. And that was a very important part of our plan, is that we brought our production down to match the current demand, which was lower as we went through this recession. I think you're seeing a fundamentally different strategy, as you pointed out, by the Detroit companies, especially Ford.
Alan Mulally is president and CEO of the Ford Motor Company. I spoke with him yesterday from the Washington Auto Show, and I continued the conversation by asking him about the state of the union for CEOs. He's the president of a company that really was founded by the man who's the stereotypical, the iconic CEO, Henry Ford. And I asked him how that's changed.
Well, Celeste, I'd go even further with your thought, because I think it's a very, very important thought. The most compelling thing about Henry Ford was that he had a very clear, compelling vision for the Ford Motor Company. I remember this quote that the real compelling vision for Ford was to open the highways to all mankind. So at the most fundamental level, I think that job, that contribution, that unique contribution of a CEO to formulate and articulate a compelling vision for the business is still probably the most important thing. It doesn't mean that you do it by yourself, but you work with all the stakeholders, you come together on what the business is really about, who the customers are going to be, what unique thing we're going to do to serve our customers. And in Ford's case, the most exciting thing about Ford is we are now accelerating the implementation of Henry's original vision. Because you look at now us focusing on Ford, a full product line, best in class in quality and fuel efficiency and safety, serving all of the customers around the world, but leveraging our size and our capability. I mean, this was Henry Ford's original vision, and we are now accelerating that vision. And I think that's a very unique, important contribution of the CEO.
But for a company like Ford, like the Big Three, or any large company, Xerox even, Delta Airlines, to a certain extent, you're a figurehead that has to take responsibility when things don't go right. I remember watching the footage of you going to Washington and having to answer the criticism of these congressmen who, you know, having covered the auto industry for a long time, had not been cooperative with the auto industry before, but were then harshly critical of decisions that were made 10, 20, even 30 years before you took the helm at Ford. So to a certain extent, a CEO has to take the fall sometimes.
Well, I think at a CEO level, you have a tremendous responsibility to all the stakeholders associated with the enterprise, the customers, our dealers, our suppliers, all the Ford employees, the UAW, our government leaders throughout the states and in the federal level. So you're absolutely right. There is a lot of responsibility, but also it's very rewarding, very satisfying, very fun.
This is a look at the State of the Union address that the president will be delivering, and we're asking different people, looking back, what do you think is the State of the Union right now? What would you say the state of our country is?
Well, I think that it's been pretty well articulated by many people that, clearly living within our means, getting the economy growing again, facilitating businesses investing and leading economic development, our trade imbalance, our deficits, our choices, what we do with our precious taxpayer money. I think these are all very, very important issues that everybody is working on. I'm looking forward to hearing what the president sees for us and what the state is and what he sees for us going forward.
Alan Mulally is the president and CEO of the Ford Motor Company. What's your State of the Union? Can you tell us in six words or less? 877-8-MY-TAKE or go to mytake@thetakeaway.org. It's 15 minutes past the hour. Let's check in now on the headlines.
And as we've been saying, the president gives his first State of the Union address tonight at 9 p.m. Eastern Time. And as you're watching it, we want you to give us a ring at 877-8-MY-TAKE with your reaction, six words or less or more, 877-8-MY-TAKE. One area he's going to touch on, having a plan in case of a bioterror attack. White House Press Secretary Robert Gibbs said yesterday there have been important strides in the area.
The president signed an executive order to establish a more rapid federal capability to provide medical countermeasures in the event of a bioattack.
Also tonight, the president won't reportedly pass the buck. Aides say he'll take responsibility for failing to deliver on some of the changes he promised 1 year ago. The president is also expected to address the $1.3 trillion deficit tonight. Yesterday, the Senate rejected a proposal to create a task force to address the debt, but that doesn't mean Congress isn't concerned. Senator John McCain says drastic measures are needed.
That requires hatchets and scalpels. It requires a hatchet to bring it under control, and it requires the scalpel to eliminate the wasteful and unnecessary spending.
Meanwhile, the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office says last year's $787 billion stimulus bill actually cost $75 billion more than that, due in part to spending on jobless benefits.
And moving to Haiti, some of those hit hardest by the earthquake are children. Dozens of lawmakers are now supporting legislation to streamline the system for bringing Haitian orphans to the U.S. Let's look at some of the stories that we're watching this morning. Coming up, what's the state of your union?
Very hot is the melting pot.
We're looking for your takes at 877-8-MY-TAKE, and we're going to take a listen to what we've heard so far.
Hey, you want that to go?
Time for some news takeouts. And first up, a House subcommittee is ready to begin its congressional inquiry into the government's role in bailing out the insurance giant American International Group, AIG. Louise Story, a business reporter for our partner, The New York Times, is here. She has a story in today's paper that previews some of the revelations that are coming to light in these hearings. What are we likely to hear today in the hearings and in Capitol Hill?
So first off, this is going to be, kind of everyone getting in a room and just attacking these politicians, these policymakers behind the decisions. And those people are Tim Geithner, who is now the Secretary of the Treasury, but you know he used to run the New York Fed when all this happened with AIG. And the New York Fed was crucial to those decisions. Republicans and Democrats both are expected to attack him because Republicans want to set themselves up for the congressional elections this year, and Democrats are kind of reeling from that Massachusetts loss in the Senate seat last week. But then we're going to have Hank Paulson, you know, who was the Treasury Secretary at the time. He will be equally attacked. So just get ready for kind of no one holding back on that. Now, we were plowing through some of the documents yesterday that have been released related to this, and my colleague Gretchen Morgenson and I did discover something that was really a revelation in terms of the fact that they had another option. So that everyone's talking about, why did AIG pay the banks 100 cents on the dollar for these contracts that AIG had with Goldman, Societe Generale, Merrill Lynch? And we discovered that there was another option they were looking at for weeks about, instead of paying the banks to end these contracts, let's make the banks give the $30 billion that they've already received from AIG, let's make them give it back to AIG.
Right. There you go.
And we'll guarantee those deals, and they don't need that collateral. So that would have made the banks really upset, but they didn't do that.
The issue there is the banks got made whole, but the taxpayers aren't going to be.
Right.
That's really
well,
the issue.
We don't know yet on the taxpayer. Now the taxpayers own all these mortgage bonds. We don't know how they're going to come through. But what we do know is the way this was handled helped the banks get whole very fast, took a lot more taxpayer money, and was possibly a lot costlier to AIG.
And you know, this AIG bailout at a price of $85 billion took place in September of 2008. That was under the Bush administration, but there's the link with Obama's administration.
That's right, Tim Geithner.
Yeah, Louise Story, thanks so much.
Well, X-raying the AIG bailout will be a very, very interesting piece of film, that's for sure. So let's look at sports. Ibrahim Abdelmateen is here, Takeaway Sports contributor. The Australian Open is underway. First of all, Djokovic seems to be headed for a match with Federer in the finals. I don't know. Where do we stand right now?
Well, right now, they call it the Grand Slam of Asia. So where we stand at the moment is that Joe Wilfried Tsonga is battling. It's a really tough match. It's in the second set right now as we speak. So if you're at home and you want to turn on and watch some tennis, you can do it right now.
Right now.
Right now. So also, Roger Federer, he lost the first set to Davinenko. But then he
came right back.
Came right back, and he won three sets in a row. Yeah. So that sets up. Andy Murray's going to be he won over Nadal, so Andy Murray going to be playing Marin Cilic, I believe that's the way you say his name, in the other semifinal. So now Roger Federer's just waiting, and it looks like just kind of like formality to see who Roger Federer's going to beat.
And I'm for Roger Federer because his name I can pronounce.
Because he's cute.
No, that's I can pronounce his name.
Most people like Roger.
I think I'm holding on.
And on
what about the women?
On the women's side, Venus Williams, she was up 5-4. In the second set, and it looked like almost that seemed set to go, that she was going to take the win. But then she just let it go, and she actually said this. She said, I was actually thinking, and it wasn't a champion's thought, if I lose today and don't win in doubles, I guess I can catch a flight on Friday. And that's not the way you're supposed to think when you're going to win.
And so it's two Chinese players in the finals now.
In the semifinals. Correct. And so... And Li Na could be the first, she could beat another Williams, and she's going to face Serena in the semifinal match. So it could be, like I said before, it is the Grand Slam of Asia. There could be two Chinese women in the final if they get past the next round, which the Zheng Ji is going to be going against Justine Henin. So Henin is on a run. She's the Kim Clijsters of this year. She's made a great comeback run this year. So we'll see. It's going to be a great semifinal in Australia.
All right. Thank you, Ibrahim Abdelmateen, Takeaway Sports contributor.
Good morning.
Working on all those Asian names. I got to work on them too.
Yeah.
The Australian Open this year. It's a revolutionary year.
For our last takeaway, we're giving our listeners the last word. More like six last words. All this week, we've been asking you what you think the state of our union is in advance of the president's State of the Union address tonight.
This is Brad from Oklahoma. My State of the Union: partisanship and fanaticism continue to divide.
Hello, this is Cheryl Aldrich from Randolph, Massachusetts. We are all in this together.
Some of you are doing a State of the Union in six words, but some of you are doing more of a response, a kind of Republican or an anti-Obama response. Listen.
Hi, Celia from Rhode Island. Don't blame Obama. Bush did this.
This is Kel in Stillwater, Oklahoma. The end result of Republican obstructionism.
But Skipper says Obama is really not a big improvement over Bush.
No change, just more hypocrisy / lies.
Yikes, use of the slash there. I wonder if that counts as a word. Thanks for calling in. Keep them coming. Keep your 6-word State of the Union, State of Obama, State of Healthcare, State of the Economy, whatever. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or post it to our website, thetakeaway.org.
And actually write that number down in a Post-it or notebook or whatever, because after you watch the address tonight, we want you to call us with your takes after the address. We want to gauge how everyone across the country is reacting, and we need your voice to make that happen.
We're still looking for your nominations on who's having a good week and a bad week this week. Every Friday we add it up with our friends at The Week magazine. It seems like it's shaping up to be a bad week for Democrats, but what do you think? Who else deserves a nod? Tell us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Coming up, how do you stabilize Afghanistan? We're going to talk about an upcoming conference of world leaders where they're going to tackle that question and what role the Taliban might play in a future Afghanistan. More in a few minutes.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Coming up, a stable Afghanistan. Does it depend on the Taliban being involved in the government? We're going to take a look at that issue in just a moment. Right now, let's check in on some top news stories at 30 minutes after the hour. An international conference in London focusing on Yemen and Afghanistan begins today. On today's agenda, Yemen, where there are fears that declining oil revenues will weaken Yemen's ability to deliver basic services, stirring dissent, and allowing terrorists to get a firmer foothold in the country. But a report in the Washington Post this morning is shedding some light on the U.S. military's current role in Yemen. It says for the past 6 weeks, U.S. military teams and intelligence agencies have been involved in joint operations with Yemeni forces, and they say they've killed 6 of the top 15 leaders of al-Qaeda in Yemen. Americans reportedly don't take part in the raids, but they plan the missions and provide the weapons. The Post also says President Obama sent U.S. military forces briefly into Somalia last year as part of an operation to kill a terrorist thought to be behind the bombing of an Israeli resort in Kenya.
President Obama's first State of the Union address is tonight. White House spokesman Robert Gibbs says the president will try to convince Americans he's got a plan to turn the economy around, but it won't be easy.
We are not going to be able to get to the top of that mountain unless we can start and continue to climb up it from the base.
Here's what we know about tonight's speech. As of this morning, the president will propose programs for education and middle-class families, as well as a spending freeze on some domestic programs and an end to the ban on gays in the military. And we want you to have a chance to weigh in as well. What, in 6 words, how would you describe the state of our union or the state of Obama's job performance?
This is Ray from Baltimore. This is so hard to put into 6 words, but I'll try. After 8 Bush, 1 year insufficient.
Reach out to us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. You can post it at our website, thetakeaway.org, and write that number down, because after you watch the State of the Union address tonight, call us with your takes on the speech. We want to gauge how everyone across the country is reacting. We want to hear your voice. 877-8-MY-TAKE. And once he's done with the State of the Union address, President Obama will travel to Florida, where he's expected to announce $8 billion in grants to develop high-speed rail corridors. The first one will likely connect Orlando and Tampa. And the FCC wants to know why termination fees for cell phones are so high. So do I. Federal regulators sent letters to the nation's largest wireless companies yesterday asking them to explain the size and rationale for their fees. Checking in on the markets, futures are mixed. The Dow gets underway at 10,194. The S&P opens at 1,092. Those are some of the news stories we're watching this morning.
So we've mentioned a conference is opening in London this week, and leaders from 60 countries are going to focus on stabilizing Afghanistan. Today they're talking about Yemen, but Afghanistan is next up. And the central issue in that conference is likely to be something that Afghan President Hamid Karzai talked about. Listen.
Those Taliban who are not part of al-Qaeda and other terrorist networks, who are the sons of the Afghan soil, and who are in thousands and thousands and thousands, they have to be reintegrated, and they're welcome to be reintegrated.
That's Hamid Karzai speaking yesterday, talking about reintegrating and separating the bad Taliban from the good Taliban. Joining us now to see how practical that even is as a strategy and as a theme for Afghanistan going forward is Fatini Christia. She's a professor of political science at MIT and rejoins the program. Good morning, Fatini.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
First of all, how difficult is it to separate productive Taliban who have a stake in the future of Afghanistan along lines that might be in the U.S. interest versus Taliban, who would not want any part of a future Afghanistan in the way that President Obama might envision it?
Everybody understands that there's no way to get to peace within a reasonable time frame in Afghanistan without engaging with the Taliban in some sort of a negotiation framework. That's why they've come up with a plan of reintegration and reconciliation. The plan has been designed by the Afghan government, but it's going to be financed by the coalition of mostly Western NATO countries. The way they're proceeding forward is they basically expect the good Taliban to self-select into this program by structuring the incentives in a way that makes sense for them to join. They understand that the people they're going to be bringing in are going to be commanders and foot soldiers, and at this stage not people like Mullah Omar, who we consider irreconcilables.
Mullah Omar, right. That was the original partner of Osama bin Laden back in 2001, right?
He was basically the head of the Afghan state under the Taliban government.
How is this not a negotiation basically for a surrender to a series of power-sharing arrangements with the Taliban and others?
This is not a surrender because the Taliban is not going to be heading the state in any shape or form, however they join and whenever they join, if it's going to be earlier or later. This is going to be a power-sharing arrangement, and there are going to be a lot of ways to guarantee that this is self-sustaining and it makes sure that the Taliban can take over the whole country.
Now, to project that this deal or any deal might work, what we've seen since the surge was announced by President Obama is the NATO troops trying to hold territory outside of Kabul and Afghan authorities trying to maintain order in Kabul. How do you think that's going? And if a deal does get put together, will NATO forces have to stay in the countryside in places like Kandahar?
The plan is moving forward is actually quite impressive. They have plans indeed to move in with forces to clear territory that's controlled by Taliban forces, but then they're also bringing in elements of the government on the subnational level. So there's a plan for a district-level initiative where the military moves in and clears, and then people are brought in practically at the same time, government officials, to ensure that there's some sort of governance in the area. And then they're also, they don't move in alone. They move in with the Afghan National Security Forces, that being the army and the police, because they have to be in charge of taking over security.
And you've witnessed some of this. I mean, I have to say, as someone who I've read repeatedly as a very harsh critic of the U.S. initiative in Afghanistan, for you to say this is impressive seems like a pretty significant turnaround.
I want to say that what is impressive about this is the degree of knowledge of the local situation and the degree of mobilization and their willingness to involve the locals to the degree that they can. They understand that this has to be an Afghan-led initiative, and the support has to be from us, from our side, in order for it to succeed. But as I said, I was quite impressed with the degree of knowledge and mobilization on the local level.
All right. Fotini Christia, professor of political science at MIT. Let me turn your political science wisdom to the U.S. for a moment. I mean, if things go along the way you're describing, there will be some sort of end date for NATO in Afghanistan, and probably Osama bin Laden will still be there somewhere, and that for a lot of the American people, the conclusion of our initiative in Afghanistan will be, well, it's a place that maybe is a little friendlier and still some really bad people can live.
I mean, the whole idea with Afghanistan is so long as it's not a staging ground for terrorist attacks against America, this is something that we should be happy to live with. It's never going to be, I mean, within a reasonable amount of time, it's not going to be a Western liberal type democracy, and this is something we have to live with. And that's not the objective of our presence there. We have to have some sort of power-sharing arrangement that makes the parties that live there happy with it. But so long as it's not a threat to our national security, I mean, this is what we need to be aspiring to.
All right, so Fotini Christia, I'm hearing a shift here. The policy has gone from nation building to containment.
That would be correct. Peace with the Taliban, and it's very feasible and the optimal strategy to follow.
All right, containment in Afghanistan, in the words of Fotini Christia, assistant professor of political science at MIT. Thanks so much. Coming up on the program, we talk about food every Tuesday. How do you make meals that your kids will enjoy eating? Well, let the kids cook. We're going to talk about the benefits of cooking with your kids later this hour. And we have an expert. Her name is Romilly. She's a child, not Julia Child. More later. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Celeste Headlee.
Thank God for Chevrolet, Harley Davidson, and RCA. They ain't perfect, but they still say, made in the USA.
Made in the USA. They probably make better song lyrics than they do policy. In Minnesota, a new state law prohibits cities, counties, and the state from buying uniforms and safety equipment from outside the country. But state employees are finding it a lot harder to put that into practice than it was originally thought. Joining me now is Gary Carlson. He's the Director of Intergovernmental Relations with the League of Minnesota Cities. Good morning, Gary.
Good morning, Celeste.
This was the brainchild of a local representative there, and I understand that he was trying to send a message about protecting American jobs. Is that right?
Yeah, he's a person that really practices what he preaches, and he proudly displays the fact that he wears Made in America clothing all the time, including all of his suits. And he just wanted our public safety officers to comply with his same lifestyle.
Okay, so it's been less than a month since this year took effect, and people are beginning to complain about it. What is the complaint?
Well, I think the major problems are that it's not always easy to find all of the products required to be manufactured in the United States and find that they are labeled appropriately. I think some of the clothing does, in fact, have the appropriate labeling, but this law also applies to safety equipment and protective accessories, and many of our cities are finding that they cannot find products that qualify under the requirements of the state law.
You know, the other problem that I understand is coming up is cost. For example, Dickies work pants are not made in the U.S. They sell for $22. Pants made entirely in Tennessee by the Southeastern Shirt Company cost $45, and that's kind of true down the line.
Yeah, that is another problem, is that even if we do find the product manufactured in the United States, that the prices can be substantially higher in some cases. And, you know, given the tough budget times that all government levels are facing right now, we're trying to pinch pennies and find the cheapest way to outfit our officers.
Now, it does have an out, this new law. It says if similar items are not available for purchase in the United States, you can buy an imported product. Is that not enough
that is
of
correct,
a...
and that is the one loophole in the law, I guess. You know, most of our cities are really trying to comply with the law, and they're trying to do their best to make sure that the products are manufactured in the U.S., but unfortunately, they're not always available or they're not always cost-effective.
Is this kind of the case of something sounding really good when it's rhetoric and not so good when it hits the paper?
Well, we did oppose this legislation last year when it was offered as an amendment to a much larger bill, and we tried to explain that many of our cities already try to shop locally or shop for products made in the U.S., but when you mandate or require that it be purchased, it does create wrinkles in procurement, and it makes it more difficult to find those products.
But this isn't a comment on the fact that so many things are made outside the USA, Gary Carlson?
That's exactly what Representative Rukavina, the author of the amendment, was trying to point out, is that we can't find many of these products made in the U.S. anymore.
Okay. Gary Carlson is the Director of Intergovernmental Relations with the League of Minnesota Cities, talking about a problematic law in Minnesota that now prohibits cities, counties, and even the state from buying uniforms that are made outside the country.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. John Hockenberry here with Celeste Headlee. And the smells in the studio. It's our food segment. Of course, every Wednesday, our food segment. And here's the issue. I mean, we all would love it if the kids would just cook their own food, right?
Absolutely.
That would be great. We can even tolerate the mess. But what if kids cooked great food? That would be something else. And that's what we're going to explore in just a minute. Right now, here's a check on leading stories at 48 minutes after the hour. The president is going to touch on a handful of fresh initiatives during his first State of the Union address tonight at 9 p.m. Eastern Time. Aides say the principal theme will be a return to the proposals that got him elected. During the speech, the First Lady will host two police officers credited with stopping the shooting rampage at Fort Hood back in November. We want to get your take on the speech. What is our State of the Union? Can you do it in 6 words? You know how to reach us, 877-8-MY-TAKE, or post it to our site, thetakeaway.org. And we want your comments on the speech later tonight, so use that number to reach us for that. Tonight, the president will also touch on the national debt. Republican Senator Judd Gregg says he's concerned for future generations.
What's coming at us is a fiscal crisis of inordinate proportions, which will probably leave this nation in a situation where it will either be fiscally bankrupt or confronting a massive reduction in the standard of living for our children.
Despite that concern yesterday, the Senate voted against creating a commission to help the country deal with the national debt.
Now moving from domestic to international fiscal health, the great and the good from the world of business and economics have gathered in the Swiss mountain retreat of Davos for this year's World Economic Forum. Economic recovery and banking reform will be the big talking points. The BBC's Bridget Kendall joins us from Davos in Switzerland. Good morning.
Good morning.
Is there expected to be some arguments between policymakers and the banking industry?
Well, I think there won't be a meeting of minds immediately. Last year, a lot of the top bankers stayed away in the aftermath of the crisis that there was. They just didn't want to be seen here, certainly not on the ski slopes or anywhere near a glass of champagne. This year, they are here, but I think a lot of the most heated discussions are going to go on in the corridors, maybe not on the podium.
And what do you hear going on in the corridors?
Well, you know, on the one hand, there are people saying, well, banks do need to be regulated more. We need to divide their retail activity away from more speculative things that they get up to, and maybe that they should not be doing that. On the other hand, there are people from the banking world who are saying, you know, too much government regulation could hamper any signs of recovery that we're seeing. So it's two sides who have two very different arguments. And I think the sense you get here in Davos is that no one has any clear vision of quite what we're going to expect going forward, given how unexpected the last year or so has been. And so there's quite a degree of uncertainty, and therefore I think a lot of heated debate.
Okay, that's Bridget Kendall from our partner, the BBC, reporting from Switzerland about the World Economic Forum. Those are some of the news stories that we're watching this morning.
Well, they're probably eating pretty well over there in Davos, wouldn't you say?
I would imagine
yes,
they are.
Not as well as we're going to be in the studio in just a moment. You know, one of the great things about the 21st century, about the internet era with the proliferation of cameras and YouTube, is that you can Google little girl squash soup and actually watch and listen to this.
Hi, I'm Logan in the kitchen, and it is really cold outside, so there's nothing better when it's cold out than a nice hot bowl of soup. So today we're making a spiced butternut squash soup that just has all the flavors of winter in it.
Yes, and the voice behind that YouTube video, it's actually Little Girl in the Kitchen. It's a TV show created by 11-year-old, right?
Yeah.
Romilly Newman, who is in the studio. Good morning.
Good morning.
And you've actually brought us a butternut squash soup.
Well, it's a tomato soup.
Tomato soup, okay, with basil and some pesto.
Right, some creme fraiche.
We're going to talk about that. But first, why did you decide to create your own cooking show as an 11-year-old?
Because I was always so, so inspired by, you know, the Food Network and all those shows. And I always watched it, and I thought, you know, having these shows teaching people how to cook would kind of be my own little way of having that.
And who's, aside from the Food Network, who's your vision of a great cook? Is it your mom?
No, she can't cook.
Oh, I see. I mean, she's in the control room there, yes.
Maybe that's why you become a good cook.
It wasn't the family where you get passed on, you know, your great-grandmother's pasta recipe, and it just wasn't that.
So this is something you initiated on your own.
Yeah, it was kind of a thing that I kind of said, let's do this.
And you've been on Good Morning America and CBS News, I believe?
The early show, yeah.
The early show, yeah. So the fact that YouTube is out there and people can find you means you've got a little bit of a following.
That's what I try to say, but,
you Well,
know.
Congratulations, Romilly Newman. And also with us is Elisa Volland, who's founder and president of Mini Chef, a cooking school for 3 to 13-year-olds right here in New York City. Good morning.
Good morning.
Now, you know, getting kids to cook is a labor-saving device for parents, but it's also a learning tool on a lot of different fronts. So what have you observed?
Well, absolutely. It's definitely a social, emotional, and also healthy benefit to getting your kids in the kitchen with you.
And, you know, we've actually discovered this in my home. Romilly, you're friends with my two 11-year-old daughters,
yes.
Zoe and Olivia. And they actually learned quite a few years ago the importance of reading by following recipes and following directions. What other skills are important for kids to learn if they cook on their own?
Sure. Well, for younger children, the 3 to 6-year-old group, I would start with counting and vocabulary. It's just a great way to get them involved in mixing and measuring. There's so many little lessons on also gross motor and fine motor skills that you can adapt and put in there. And then for the older kids, you can really have greater conversations about how's their day at school, what's going on in their life. It's really an introduction to more social bonding issues.
And then there are also people like Romilly Newman, where it's all about you being a star, right?
In a way, but I like to, I think, teaching kids about what they're eating and...
Really? So
and
that's important to you?
What they're, yeah, I think it's very important that, you know, healthy food can
healthy
taste
food.
Good.
All right, here's a question I have. All right, I've got 5 kids. All right, a lot of different approaches to eating, okay? And it's always... And I remember what I used to eat as a kid. Do you think of kid food as like an ethnic food? Like there's Hungarian food, there's Polish food, there's Italian food, and there's kid food. And if so, what would that be?
I think there is that. And I think it's kind of, you know, food that, you know, is kind of junky. And so I think that you have to kind of open your kids, you know, open the doors to your kids' food world.
So kid food is kind of narrow. So if I was making a salad and I put feta cheese on it, that's adult. If I put Rice Krispies on it, that's...
Kid.
Uh-huh.
But I try to make it, you know, I try to teach kids that feta cheese can taste good.
Well, Celeste has a question for you. I'm going to get her
well,
a bowl
I mean, you know,
ready
one
of
this
tomato
that's
soup
a big, here. It's a big barrier, Elisa and Romilly, is that the look of food. Very often kids are afraid because something looks, to quote my son, gross. And it takes a number of bites before they realize that what looks disgusting to them, it doesn't taste so bad. Romilly?
How do you get kids past gross?
Yeah.
I think you have to kind of, you know, you have to just have them try it. And there are also ways to kind of hide vegetables, hide things, you know? You know, you can make a mashed potato with turnip in it. But, you know, they don't see that, but it just tastes good and they're getting their vegetables.
Elisa,
you know?
Do you teach vegetable hiding techniques?
Well, sure, absolutely, especially with children. You have to weave in the good stuff, basically, to get kids to eat it. But also the other thing is there are so many companies out there right now that are making molds, so you can make things in different shapes that are much more appealing to kids. You can make butterflies and bees, and they just have a greater interest in trying these foods if they like what they're eating.
Well, madame, I have a bowl of this for you. And Romilly, will you explain what it is that Celeste is eating here?
It's my take on, like, the classic tomato soup. Every kid loves tomato soup, so it has some red peppers in it, and it's kind of...
It's really flavorful.
Thank you.
Garnished with some pesto?
Some pesto oil.
Pesto oil? You made this pesto oil?
Pesto. You can buy store-bought pesto even and just water it down with olive oil, and then you kind of drizzle that on.
So what is your vision for Little Girl in the Kitchen, Romilly Newman?
I try to make it a wide variety. I try to make it food that not only is just for kids or just for adults. I try to make it food that kind of anyone can eat and anyone can love. And that's what I want.
But does that really mean you want to get on the Food Network? Is that really? Yeah, maybe.
That was one of the challenges.
All right. Elisa, take us out. What's a last thought for moms who are thinking of maybe letting their kids, or dads thinking of letting their kids actually get near the burners?
The last thought is actually it's much easier to cook with your kids than people think. There's so many things that kids can do in the kitchen, from prepping to mixing before they actually hit the oven.
All right. Well, thanks so much for the tomato soup, Romilly Newman and Elisa Volland. Kids can cook. Kids should cook. Kids, get cooking. It's breakfast time.
And you can catch a few episodes of Romilly's show. Go to our website, thetakeaway.org. We'll have links for you there. And we're also asking you, tonight is President Obama's State of the Union address. We've been asking you to describe the State of the Union, if you can, in 6 words. And on our website, we heard from some kids. Laura writes, I decided to pose this prompt to my students in my 10th grade advisory. Here's what they came up with. Big mass chaos, cleaning time. That's one.
Excellent.
Bad economy, no one is acting. Pick up our mess, become one. What the bleep is going on? And lazy get fat, smart get strong.
You know how to reach us.
877-8-MY-TAKE.
Together. 877-8-MY-TAKE. There we go.
Or their website, thetakeaway.org. I'm Celeste Headley.
And I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway. Now give me some of that soup.
Okay.
Thanks for listening to the Takeaway Podcast. If there's a story you think we should look at or a conversation you'd like us to start, drop us a line at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.